Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 20th of August, these are our main stories. Police in New York City sack an officer 5 years after he held an unarmed black man in a chokehold, resulting in his death. Twitter and Facebook say they've uncovered a Chinese government misinformation campaign designed to sow discord in Hong Kong. A court in El Salvador has pardoned a woman convicted under the country's strict abortion laws. Also in this podcast,
for the police to release such a statement that incites people to report anyone that knows anything about the organization, which translates to people reporting anyone that they know who might be LGBT or queer.
An LGBT group in the West Bank is horrified after police begin a crackdown on their members. 5 years ago, Eric Garner was illegally selling loose cigarettes on a street in New York City when he was arrested. Video footage which shows him crying, "I can't breathe," as he's placed in a chokehold, horrified many and became one of the rallying cries of the Black Lives Matter movement. On Monday, the officer who placed Mr. Garner in that chokehold, which contributed to his death, was sacked by the NYPD. A few hours after the announcement, his daughter Emerald addressed the media.
Daniel Pantaleo is a murderer, and that's just how I feel. I feel that he could have gotten off of Eric Garner. I feel that he made a choice, and everybody has a choice.
The mayor of New York City, Bill de Blasio, said the case should be a turning point.
We must devote ourselves to this simple goal, that no person, no family, no community should ever go through the agony that we've all experienced here over these last years. It should never happen again in this city or this country. Let this be the last tragedy.
Our New York correspondent is Nick Bryant.
You remember a summer 5 years ago when Eric Garner, an African-American man who was illegally selling cigarettes in Staten Island, was tackled by a police officer who held him in a chokehold, and he died an hour later. Now that police officer, Daniel Pantaleo, has been sacked. And the city's police commissioner, James O'Neill, said today that that would happen because he could no longer effectively serve.
As you said, Eric Garner died 5 years ago. Why has this taken such a long time?
Well, that's the question that the family of Eric Garner has been asking today. They called immediately for Daniel Pantaleo to be fired. A grand jury in Staten Island declined to indict him in 2014 on criminal charges. Federal prosecutors said last month that they would not bring charges against him because they said there was insufficient evidence. But there have been a lot of pressure from the African-American community in New York in particular, and leading civil rights activists in New York City, to have him fired. But James O'Neill, the police commissioner, it was obviously a difficult decision for him. He said that if he was in that situation, he could imagine doing something of the same thing. He said that Daniel Pantaleo hadn't come to work that day seeking to harm anybody.
And it seems, just looking at the reaction, that this case really divides people. The police union absolutely furious that this has happened, but others are saying this is too little, too late.
Yeah, the family of Eric Garner have welcomed this decision, but they would like to see other police officers who were involved in Eric Garner's arrest to be disciplined as well. The chokehold contributed to Eric Garner's death, but so too did the chest compressions of him being held on the ground, and he was being held on the ground by a number of police officers.
And how significant is this case in terms of the whole Black Lives Matter movement?
This case really contributed in a massive way. Indeed, the words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry for campaigners, not just in New York City, but across the country against police brutality. Eric Garner's death also led to a reevaluation of what's called the broken windows strategy of the NYPD, which was to really come down hard, to show zero tolerance against fairly minor crimes. But Eric Garner's death really was one of those kind of landmark cases which really did provide a big spur for the Black Lives Matter campaign.
That was Nick Bryant. Twitter and Facebook say they've blocked a state-backed Chinese campaign against the pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. The two social media firms said fake accounts had posted as media organisations to try to undermine the activists. From San Francisco, here's our technology reporter, Dave Lee.
Twitter said it removed 936 accounts that had been spreading material intended to undermine the legitimacy and political positions of the protest movement in Hong Kong. Twitter also suspended some 200,000 other accounts that were created to amplify the posts. Facebook said it acted on a tip-off from Twitter and removed 7 pages, 3 groups and 5 accounts linked to the misinformation campaign. In a related announcement, Twitter said it would no longer accept advertising from state-controlled media companies following criticism it received for allowing ads from Chinese state media.
To El Salvador now, where a 21-year-old woman has been cleared in a retrial after earlier being convicted of illegally aborting her baby as a teenager. Evelyn Hernandez had been raped and always maintained that she hadn't been aware that she'd been pregnant. Prosecutors had asked for a sentence of 40 years. Our Central America correspondent Will Grant reports.
The judge in Evelyn Hernandez's retrial was faced with two options: pardon her or return her to prison for decades. In the end, despite the efforts by the state prosecutor's office to have her sent back to jail, Miss Hernandez has been cleared of the aggravated homicide charges against her. The judge agreed with her argument that she'd been unjustly sentenced for murder for having a stillbirth. Her supporters have long said that Evelyn was, in fact, the victim in this case, having become pregnant as a teenager through rape. Given the shocking nature of the original sentence, 30 years in prison for homicide, the case was widely criticised by women's rights groups in Central America and in the international media. Miss Hernandez had consistently said she had no idea she was pregnant. Evelyn Hernandez is now free. However, numerous similar cases still exist in El Salvador of women in prison on murder charges for alleged abortions. The country's president, Nayib Bukele, is socially conservative, but said to be broadly in favour of relaxing the total ban on abortion, at least in cases where the mother's life is at risk.
That was Will Grant. The tension between Iran and the United States is continuing after the release of an Iranian oil tanker by Gibraltar. The British territory rejected a request made by Washington to seize the tanker. Tehran has warned that any attempt by America to detain the tanker will have very serious consequences. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner reports.
On the high seas at last and proceeding eastwards at a sedate 7 knots, the tanker at the centre of a diplomatic row is making its way across the Mediterranean, heading for the Greek port of Kalamata. The Grace One, now given the more Persian-sounding name of Adrian Daria One, left Gibraltar last night after the authorities there refused to comply with a US Department of Justice request to detain it for alleged links to Iran's Revolutionary Guards. Washington has designated them a terrorist organisation, but the EU has not, and Gibraltar follows EU and not US law. Iran has warned the US not to try to seize the tanker. Its foreign minister, Javad Zarif, has said this whole affair is politically motivated.
Because of US sanctions, we cannot be very transparent with the destination of our oil because the United States illegally tries to bully others from purchasing our oil.
The real issue at the root of all this is the Iran nuclear deal, which is supposed to lift sanctions on Tehran in exchange for intrusive nuclear inspections. The Trump administration pulled out of it last year and is slowly strangling the Iranian economy through tightening sanctions. The European Union disagrees with this approach and wants to keep the deal alive. Britain, which has one of its own flag tankers currently impounded by Iran, would like to see a de-escalation. But if the US does try to intercept the Iranian tanker, the country has warned it to expect heavy consequences.
Frank Gardner. This weekend, members of fascist groups marched through the US city of Portland, though they were heavily outnumbered by anti-fascist demonstrators. There have been calls from human rights groups in the US to do more to curb hate speech, particularly after attacks targeting minorities. But it was the anti-fascist groups in Portland that were condemned by President Trump on social media. Our North America correspondent, Aleem McBool, was at the rally and has been looking into the state of white white nationalism in the US.
USA! USA! USA!
Neo-fascist groups appear to be on the march in the US. We accompanied hundreds of members of one organisation that call themselves the Proud Boys as they took to the streets of Portland in Oregon, flashing their white power signs at us all day.
This is a historic day right here. This is going to be one of the largest protests in Portland history.
But the group's leader, Joe Biggs, claimed they were out to protest against the militancy of the far left.
Why come out on the streets today?
I just want people to understand that these masked people running around committing acts of violence and, you know, criminal activity needs to come to an end.
Go home, Nazis! Go home, Nazis!
And there are often masked anti-fascist activists and many other Americans out to confront white supremacists when they march. Now, a few scuffles aside, police made sure the day in Portland remained mainly peaceful. But it is unquestionably those linked with far-right ideologies who've been responsible for the most deadly violence of late. The most recent being the murders of 22 people in El Paso, a majority Latino city, killed by a white gunman who told officers he wanted to shoot as many Mexicans as possible.
Every people has to have a homeland, and this is ours.
Another group that espouses white supremacist ideas is the League of the South. Its leader, Michael Hill, gave me his reaction to the El Paso attack.
I really am surprised it doesn't happen more often, because you look at these young white guys. They're being displaced. They're told that they're part of the patriarchy. They're told that they have this white privilege, and they're looking around and they're saying, "Where's my white privilege? I can't get a job." You know, and I know a lot of young.
Why should there be white privilege though?
Because we created this country. It should be our privilege.
But the group having its meeting in Florida somehow claims not to be racist, just as they claim they don't condone violence. Even though a member of this group was jailed after he was caught on video brutally beating an African-American man after the now notorious supremacist rally in Charlottesville.
For so many years we've been worried about brown-skinned people coming here to cause terror, when in fact we've had hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of people already within our country who are ready to act in those same terroristic ways.
In the 90s, Christian Piccolini was a prominent leader and recruiter in the white power movement. He was also the lead singer in a supremacist metal band, whose lyrics were even quoted by the gunman who killed 9 people in a black church in Charleston. Christian denounced neo-Nazism and now works to de-radicalize supremacists. So why the apparent rise in white supremacy now?
For so many, you know, of the 80s and 90s, they were on the fringes. It was a large organization, it was a deadly organization, but it was not part of the mainstream by any means. And now today, where we're seeing the rhetoric that, you know, I used to say 30 years ago, almost verbatim coming out of the president's mouth, they're tired of waiting. Now they see it as an opportunity to act.
At the far-right rally in Portland, the uniform of choice for many was Trump campaign paraphernalia, Make America Great Again hats and Trump 2020 flags. He may say he opposes white supremacy. It's clear they think, more and more, they've got the president on their side.
That was Aleem Mukbul. Still to come on this podcast.
It's using MDMA in a therapeutic setting. So they have about 6 or 7 hours of therapy. So they're working through the traumas of their life.
We hear how the illegal drug MDMA is being used to tackle alcohol addiction. Police in the Palestinian Authority have banned an LGBT rights group from organising activities in the West Bank and threatened to arrest them, saying such activities are against the values of Palestinian society. The ban was posted on Facebook by the spokesman for police, as I heard from our correspondent in Jerusalem, Yolan Nell.
He talks about the actions of the LGBTQ group Al-Kaus, which is basically means rainbow in Arabic. And he refers to them having held a recent event in the conservative Palestinian city in the West Bank, Nablus, and talks about them as knocking a blow to the ideals and values of Palestinian society and acting against the monotheistic religions. Now, strictly speaking, same-sex relations aren't against the law in the West Bank, but homosexuality is a big taboo here, and he's asking members of the Palestinian public with any information about the group to come forward and report them to the police. If you look on that Facebook page of the police, members of the Palestinian public, a lot of them come out with very negative comments. One comment says, "All respect to the police, shame on all of you. Arrest them and burn them all," says another, in reference to gay people.
What is life like for LGBT people there? I mean, are they allowed to be open about their sexuality, or is it very much hidden because they're scared of reprisals?
It is very difficult for people, particularly in the occupied West Bank. I should say that in the Gaza Strip, this can lead more directly to imprisonment. It's more overtly seen as being against the law. The Gaza Strip, of course, which is run by the Islamist group Hamas. But then there is this LGBTQ advocacy group, and they have been alarmed by what's happened. They say that they've been going for years without ever having attracted police attention of this kind. And Mohammed Abu Ramillah from Al Kaus criticised the police for creating what he said was an atmosphere of persecution and intimidation.
That was still shocking to us, for the police to release such a statement that incites people to follow or to report anyone that knows anything about the organisation, which translates to people reporting anyone that they know who might be LGBT or queer in their lives as well. And we think that's very dangerous.
Mohammed Abu Ramillah from the LGBT group Al Kaus. Could an illegal drug help in the treatment of addiction to a legal drug? Researchers in Britain say that a study they've been carrying out suggests that MDMA, the recreational drug commonly known as ecstasy, can help treat alcohol addiction safely and effectively. Tim Frank spoke to one of those involved in the research, David Nutt, Professor of Neuropsychopharmacology at Imperial College London.
What we've shown is that if you take people with alcohol dependence, alcoholism, and give them two sessions of MDMA in the same way as MDMA is used to help people with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, you can get them to work through the traumas, which many of them are drinking to forget. So it was a small study. It was designed just to see whether it was safe to give MDMA to people with the medical problems that accompany alcoholism. But also, for most of them, it was actually beneficial in that they managed to significantly cut down their drinking for weeks and months afterwards.
So it's a gateway to therapy, in a sense. It's not a chemical cure in itself.
Now, that's a good point. So let's be clear, we're not giving them ecstasy every day. It's not like a traditional medicine, say like an antidepressant. No, it's using MDMA in a therapeutic setting. So the actual day, the day they get the treatment, so they get two of these 2 weeks apart, they have about 6 or 7 hours of therapy. So they're working through the traumas of their life, trying to make sense of why they're drinking, what are they trying to forget, what are the issues which have damaged them.
I hardly need tell you that MDMA is widely known as ecstasy. Is there any danger that in giving people who are known to be dependent on one drug, another drug, which does have a psychotropic effect?
Well, that's a great question.
You know, there's a danger in that.
I don't think there is, and I'll tell you why. The first thing to say is that MDMA was being used widely in psychotherapy back in the 1960s and 70s, and it was called empathy. It was only when it was renamed ecstasy and was sold as a legal alternative to amphetamines in clubs and raves that it actually came to the attention of the authorities. And the evidence that MDMA is harmful when it's used in a therapeutic session is virtually nil. So that's the first thing to say. The second thing is it's not addictive, whereas alcohol is. And the third thing is we're giving it twice. And we are following people up and we are asking them whether they've actually gone off and taken some more subsequently, and they haven't. So I think ecstasy has been given a really bad rap ever since its name was changed from empathy. And I'd like to change its name back now, because that's where it has its therapeutic value, giving people empathy to them, to their own feelings, and also with therapists.
But you wouldn't presumably go so far as to say that if somebody were listening to this or has found out about your study and they are trying to deal with their alcoholism, that they should somehow self-medicate with ecstasy?
I would definitely not say that for several reasons. One is you don't know what you're getting, and there's been a spate of deaths from other sort of analogues of ecstasy like PMA, which are more dangerous. Secondly, this is a very challenging experience. We have two therapists with the patient. It's hugely stressful. It needs to be done in a controlled setting with experts to help you guide you. It's possible that if people were just to go and self-medicate and try to relive things, they might get worse. So no, absolutely not. Categorically, don't try this at home.
That was Professor David Nutt from Imperial College London speaking to Tim Franks. Dairy farmers around the world are at the mercy of climate change, trade wars and volatile milk prices, and all that is taking a toll. Like others, American dairy farmers are struggling to survive. Last year, nearly 3,000 dairy farms closed in the US, and that number continues to grow every day. From Wisconsin, the BBC's Angelica Kasser reports.
My life pretty much revolved around the farm, I guess. It's always been important to me, and it's what I've always wanted to do. I guess I've always wanted to farm. Kind of the last couple of years, I kind of hoped maybe, you know, just things would get better, but they really haven't.
American dairy farmers like Noah Volker are in crisis.
They say get bigger, get out, and I didn't really foresee, you know, I don't want to get bigger just to make a go of it. So my decision I came up with was just to get out of it.
The Volker family have just loaded up the last of their cows for auction. After 79 years, they're shutting down their dairy farm. And they're not alone. Nearly 700 dairy farms in Wisconsin have closed in the last year.
America's dairyland in crisis.
More and more Wisconsin dairy farmers are going out of business.
Tonight, fear from dairy farmers struggling to make ends meet.
It is definitely not an exaggeration to say that dairy farmers are in crisis right now.
FarmAid's Jennifer Fahey says there isn't an agricultural sector under more strain than dairy.
Over the past 5 years, dairy farmers have seen their income plummet by about 50%. We have not seen a prolonged downturn like this in a long time. And it's bleeding our country dry of dairy farmers.
A few years ago, farmers were earning around $20 US for every 100 pounds of milk they produced. Now, they make about 16. Milk prices have been below average for years. That's not the only reason family-owned dairy farms are closing.
One of the problems we have in the dairy industry is with consolidation, where small and mid-sized farmers are being pushed out of business and the greater share of production is being taken on by larger and larger farms.
Big corporations and grocery chains are making moves to create their own supply of food.
Last year, we saw Walmart announce that they would be cutting the contract with their processor and opening their own processing facility.
The decision allows Walmart to control every aspect of milk production. It's great for Walmart and other corporations doing the same, but it also means many of the farmers and dairy processors that once sold to the grocery giant no longer have contracts.
We've been ingrained to believe that milk should be cheap, which makes it really difficult to motivate people to say, hey, farmers aren't earning a fair price, let's fight for this.
That challenge is playing out in Wisconsin, home to one-fourth of all U.S. dairy farms. The majority, like Noah's, are family-operated.
It was a nice way to grow up. You know, we worked alongside each other in the family, you know.
And the cows are part of the family.
Each one of the cows have their own personality. Some are hyper, some are really gentle, some won't leave you alone, they'll lick you to death and you can't get away from them. I mean, there's just, yeah, it's kind of neat. That's one part I'm going to miss about it is, you know, just kind of each cow's personality.
Like Noah, many farmers across the U.S. are opting out of the industry. Jennifer believes this trend is having a huge ripple effect across rural communities.
A lot of us might be lucky to feel that our job is more than just a job and it's part of our identity. But for farmers, many of whom have had that farm passed down for generations, it's an identity, it's a legacy, and that pressure of possibly being the generation to lose it all is so immense, most of us can't imagine it.
That was Angelica Kasser. A French couple who were caught with 40 kilograms of Sardinian sand in their car have been warned they could face up to 6 years in prison. The pair say they collected the sand as a souvenir and didn't realise they'd committed a crime. Our Rome correspondent James Reynolds takes up the story.
Sardinia's famous white sand comes with a set of very singular rules. You can sunbathe on it, make sandcastles with it, but don't, whatever you do, try to take any of it out of the country. The authorities want to stop tourists from selling it online. 2 years ago, the government brought in a law that makes the trade in sand, pebbles and shells illegal. The police in Sardinia regularly search airports and ferries. Reports say that one French couple tried to leave the island with 14 plastic bottles of sand in the boot of their car. The bottles weighed a total of 40 kilograms. The couple say that they'd simply collected the sand as a souvenir and were unaware that they'd committed a criminal offence. Normally, tourists caught with sand can face a fine of up to 3,000 euros. But this couple faces the possibility of time in prison.
That was James Reynolds. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.